Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Joseph Smith was a charismatic, visionary leader who inspired deep devotion but also deep disillusionment. He claimed direct access to God, and he used that authority to make these sweeping decisions. He introduced new rituals and revelations, but he also took more than 30 plural wives, including teenagers and women who were already married. He used seer stones and folk magic to translate scripture. He excommunicated those who challenged him and demanded secrecy and loyalty from those who stayed. In his new biography, the historian John Turner says that by April of 1844, just weeks before he was killed, Joseph Smith was trying to quell these growing doubts about his leadership, even as he pushed his followers to embrace his most ambitious and most dangerous visions yet.
Over the first few months of 1844, it seemed as if everything might be falling apart for Joseph Smith. One issue was polygamy. There were some public feuds about Joseph's practice of plural marriage. There's external critics, internal critics, quarrels at church meetings. He had critics who were accusing him of being a false teacher and a false prophet. Joseph's leadership is very much in doubt. So he felt that his prophetic back was up against the wall, and he wanted to refute his critics. And so in early April 1844, an enormous number of church members have gathered for this multi-day conference. And Joseph decided to take on a lot of the doubts about his leadership. Joseph tells them that he's never been in a nearer relationship to God than at that very moment. He gave a remarkable sermon that became known as the King Follett Discourse, because one catalyst was the death of a church member named King Follett, who was killed in an accident while building a well. And in this sermon, one of the things that he says is that if he can bring his listeners to God, all persecution against him will cease. He decides to go back to first principles. You know, who is God? Who are human beings? And part of this was about the fact that human life was frail. People died, sometimes tragically, like King Follett. But some of this is also strikingly original. Joseph teaches the congregation that they can not only look forward to an eternity with God, but that they themselves can be exalted unto godhood. He tells them that they have to learn how to be a God yourself, that there is this divine potential within humanity. These principles weren't necessarily new for Joseph Smith, but he advanced them boldly and clearly right at this time that many people are questioning his leadership. Then Joseph stops and he maintains that he's misunderstood. "You never knew my heart," Joseph laments. "No man knows my history." And then he returns to his own standing within the church. And he tells the people that God has made him their king and their God. And so he says, if you don't like it, you must lump it. I think there's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek here. I think Joseph is essentially saying he's in charge of the church, and some people might not like the way he's leading the church, but he's not going to change. So I see two things at play here. This is a prophet under siege, and he's standing up at this conference and he's taking it on and he's not backing down. And at the same time, I do think Joseph has serious doubt about whether he's going to be able to prevail in the spring of 1844. He never loses that sense of bold defiance. But at the same time, I think he fears he's not going to be able to overcome his critics and his opponents this time. This isn't a farewell address, but I think Joseph also has principles that he wants to teach the saints while he can. And I think he does have a nagging fear that his time on earth is growing short.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, John Turner is with us talking about his new biography, Joseph Smith, The Rise and Fall of an American Prophet. And we're actually going to do this in two parts, this week and next week. Part of what we'll get at in this first hour is Turner's approach, how he handles the question of whether Smith was a fraud, how much of the story, like his visions and the golden plates, were made up. As you'll hear, Turner tries to navigate around the truth claims of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But that's not easy. He says a lot of the questions are a matter of faith, not history. In his book, Turner describes Joseph Smith as a white whale for biographers.
He's easy to spot. I mean, he's so colorful, and he's one of the more attractive biographical figures in the history of American religion. I think there's no doubt about that. His activities are so varied and so remarkable and so controversial. At the same time, it's pretty hard to catch hold of Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
His life is pretty well documented. The sources are very accessible, but they also fail you at key moments. And so as a historian, there are some episodes in Joseph's life, such as the coming forth of the Book of Mormon or Joseph's polygamy. They're hard to interpret because it's hard to get a hold of Joseph himself at those moments and try to narrate them as he was experiencing and understanding them.
Do you think it was because he tried to cultivate this idea of being an enigma in some way? He liked there being some kind of mystery? I mean, I guess the skeptic could say, well, he's hiding this stuff because he's hiding the fact that he's a fraud or that he's a womanizer, or that, you know, all of those kinds of things. What explains the fact that it's hard to actually get to some of those really critical questions about his life?
I mean, in those two instances, you know, there's something to the way that you frame the question. I mean, Joseph chose not to say a great deal about the coming forth of the Book of Mormon, even when individuals would invite him to do so. And plural marriage was something that he did, of course, try to keep secret. But I think in a more general sense, Joseph, I mean, he was effusive. He had, you know, we have a lot of his words documented, especially toward the end of his life. He wasn't introspective. So when he would speak to congregations about all sorts of subjects, it's not that he wasn't speaking from his heart, but he wasn't inviting congregations or other listeners into his heart. He didn't, he didn't try to explain so much what he was experiencing or get us inside his mind.
It's a cliche question to ask, but let me sort of go for it here. Does the world need another Joseph Smith biography? And it's a good question, but what was wrong, I guess I'll put it this way, if anything, with some of the other biographies? I mean, you've talked about Von Brody's biography, No Man Knows My History, being a really critical document, but kind of dated. Richard Bushman has, of course, written his biography, but he's coming at it from the perspective of a believer. It sounds like in some ways maybe you just wanted a crack at this yourself, but why does the world need another biography?
I was going to quip and say after this one, you know, that's it.
There's
no need for any more. No, I mean, I didn't write mine because of any particular deficiencies in prior Joseph Smith biographies. I actually did just want to crack at it. Mm. But that's partly because there's so much to say about Joseph's life. There are a lot of choices that biographers have to make. I think in terms of the two biographies you mentioned, I admire both of them. But Von Brody completed the first edition of her biography in 1945. It's 2025. There's just a lot more information available. And, you know, my approaches are different from hers. I'm a huge admirer of Richard Bushman as both a historian and simply as an individual. I wanted to write something that was faster paced, that also was not from a faithful Latter-day Saint perspective. So I guess I'd simply say there was definitely room for one more biography.
What is it that interests you about Joseph Smith? I mean, beyond the fact that he's a truly fascinating character, he's a remarkable religious innovator. One of the things you say in the book is that you were interested in the way that Smith's life intersected with the larger trajectory, the broader trajectory of Christian thought and practice at the time. So there is that. What is it that interests you about that part?
So that is a big part of it for me. I grew up in really an evangelical Protestant tradition.
Yeah.
And growing up in that tradition, I really thought that that was what Christianity was, or at least what it should be. And one of the things that has long attracted me to the Latter-day Saint movement is here's a Christian movement that really asks different questions, or at least provides really different answers to some key questions. So that's one thing that attracts me about Joseph Smith. He has this really lifelong engagement with the Bible. I think that's actually a thread through a lot of his activity. And he just asks great fundamental questions. You know, what do I have to do to be saved? How should I prepare for Christ's imminent return? Or what do I need to do to be with my loved ones forever? And he keeps asking these questions. Toward the end of his life, he's returning to questions such as, what kind of a being is God? What is the relationship between God the Father and Jesus Christ, between God and human beings? A lot of Christians down through the centuries have asked the same questions. I see Joseph Smith as part of that longer Christian tradition. His answers are often original and provocative. To me, that's definitely part of the fascination.
I wanted to get your sense of what it is that different types of people are hoping to get from your biography. And I think you know what I mean by that. I mean, believers are looking to confirm their ideas about Joseph Smith as a true prophet and visionary. But then there are critics who are hoping that this will finally confirm their belief about Joseph Smith, that he was a fake. How do you contend with that expectation from different types?
I guess for starters, for me, that wasn't the key question. So I wasn't coming to this biography on Joseph Smith's life in order to try to answer the question of whether or not he truly was God's chosen prophet for this dispensation. Yeah. I wasn't seeking evidence to either affirm him as a prophet or convict him as a fraud. Now, I'm not saying that I'm just simply, therefore, above the fray. I definitely try to weigh in on some of the key controversial questions about his life. But for me, I'm more interested in how does he fit into that larger story of Christianity? And then also just the basic human story of how does this young man without very much formal education from this totally impoverished background, how does he produce something like the Book of Mormon, found a church, attract thousands of followers? Trying to figure that out for me is, you know, that's just more of a historical and biographical question than ultimately trying to settle the question of whether he's a prophet or a fraud.
It's this thing you mentioned, the Mormon scholar Jan Shipps once said, that scholars need to sort of get past the, you know, the portrait of Smith as either a fraud or, an anointed prophet, and search for what you call or what she called an integrated understanding of the man. What do you understand about an integrated understanding of the man?
I mean, my answer to that is actually slightly different in that I don't think as a historian, I don't think I need to write a biography of Joseph Smith that would be satisfactory to both believers and skeptics, like a sort of naturalistic portrait of Smith that people on all sides might accept. I'm really trying to be more simple. This is Joseph Smith, how I understand him. I think there will be elements of, or I know there are elements of what I wrote that faithful Latter-day Saints will feel uncomfortable with, and that skeptics will also find unsatisfactory. But when you're writing a book like this, I think the best way to do it is to try not to please. You want people to enjoy reading it, but you can't try to please everyone. I think you just have to lay out your best judgment and tell the best story you can and hope that it resonates with people and that in some way they find it profitable, regardless of how they come down on the profit question.
John Turner, he's a professor of religious studies at George Mason University. His book is Joseph Smith, The Rise and Fall of an American Prophet. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the historian John Turner. We're talking about his new biography of Joseph Smith. And no surprise, Smith is hard to define. He dug for treasure, he practiced polygamy, he took big risks, he loved spectacle and power. But Turner also shows Smith as a builder of temples and a writer of scripture. And he says his religious vision caught hold because it spoke to the questions that people were asking. Why am I here? How can I be with my loved ones forever? Which of these churches is true? Turner, though, was trying to shift the focus from whether Joseph Smith was a fraud or a prophet to make sense of the man for believers and skeptics. His book is called Joseph Smith, The Rise and Fall of an American Prophet. You say Joseph Smith's success was, this is how you describe it, unlikely in the extreme. Explain why. And I guess we should sort of key in on that. The term you use, he grew up in a downwardly mobile family. Explain.
Yeah, it's almost the American nightmare. You know, it's the opposite of the American dream. So his, you know, he's born in Vermont in 1805, just shortly after his father, Joseph Smith Sr., has staked his land and reputation on an ill-fated attempt to ship ginseng to China. Basically, he and Joseph's mother, Lucy Mack Smith, they lose their land. It's an incredible setback. And the family really drifts around for the next 10 years, trying to make a new start, never making a really successful one. And then they decide to try again and move to Western New York, to Palmyra, and then Manchester. They do obtain land there, but they lose title to that land, that farm as well. So it's a life of setbacks. One thing that does strike me about Joseph's parents, and particularly Joseph's mother, is these are people who are resilient. You know, they do keep taking another crack at it. I do think Joseph, you know, I mean, there are all sorts of sort of rags to riches or rags to political success stories in the United States. I mean, Joseph's circumstances are really destitute in the 1820s. People remember all sorts of things about the Smith family, often critical, sometimes more admiring, but they all seem to agree on the destitution. This is not a family that's on the up. And Joseph, I think, is determined to burst out of that failure and also banality to some extent. He just has grander aspirations, and it takes a remarkable spirit, confidence, audacity to try to move in a really different direction.
When do you think it is that he starts to give some form to those aspirations, to what that ambition might be? He wanted to get out of this downwardly mobile existence, but when did he get a sense of what that might mean? He didn't want to be a He didn't want to work a farm like his father-in-law said he should be. Just be a farmer, that you could prosper there. Seems like he wanted something else, but surely he didn't conceive of himself as a prophet early on. Like, what? How did he? If we know this at all, how did he think about his, you know, what form his ambition may take?
It's a great question. I think one of the things that is really difficult as a historian is we just don't have great sources for Joseph's life in the 1820s. Now, there are sources. There's the, you know, canonical history of Joseph's life, the Joseph Smith history. There are a few other documents like that. We have a history dictated by Lucy Mack Smith from the mid-1840s. But we don't have a lot of contemporary information. So it's hard to answer that question. It may be that when Joseph begins to have visionary experiences as a young man, he begins to contemplate a new and different direction for his life. You know, if those accounts have something to them, and I think they do, I think it'd be hard not to think along those lines once you begin having such remarkable experiences. I don't think, though, that Joseph really takes center stage, even in his own family, and really charts a path forward until around 1827. He has been working as a day laborer, a farmhand.
Yeah.
He's also found employment digging for buried treasures. And in the fall of 1827, everything coalesces around the story of golden plates containing an ancient record. And when you think about the unlikeliness of what transpires next, Joseph's new direction ultimately involves the publication of a book. And he's hoping that'll be both the economic salvation, really, of his household and his family, and then also articulate a religious vision that will lead to the formation of a church. Those are remarkable goals for a 21-year-old downwardly mobile farmhand as of 1827.
I want to ask about the influence of his mother. I was struck by her story. She has two sisters who die from tuberculosis. And one of the things you mentioned was the fact that this disease had killed them was terrifying to her, Lucy Mack Smith, because, as you put it in the book, she was not spiritually prepared for death. And if it was going to come for her, she wasn't ready. She hadn't had that thing that she heard at church, which is a change of heart. And you describe her, in fact, as being in agony because she hadn't had such an experience. Now, this, if you know the story of Joseph Smith, that he has this deeply spiritual experience asking God to forgive his sins and tell him the right way, it makes me think, was he inspired by, drawn to the story of his mother? Talk about her influence in all of that.
Sure. So, yeah, that thing that you're referring to is, you know, basically a, you know, Protestant conversion experience. So Lucy and Joseph Smith Sr., they are not church members, but they are Christians.
Yeah.
So Lucy certainly believes in Jesus Christ. She wants to feel an assurance that God has forgiven her sins and that she will ultimately be saved. That's what she wants. And this, I think, is sort of a classic Protestant problem. She can't will herself into that spiritual or emotional experience. But she, you know, when she herself is thinking that she has tuberculosis and might die, you know, she begs God to let her live. She promises that if she survives, she's going to endeavor to get that religion, which is really such an American phrase, to get religion.
Yeah.
And she does recover. She doesn't ever quite have that experience. Mm. She's a real searcher. She is attracted to the Methodists. She's later attracted to the Presbyterians. Her husband, Joseph Smith Sr., doesn't want to have anything to do with them. But I agree, Joseph, I don't know whether it's due to his mother's influence or due to simply seeing revival meetings in and around Palmyra. Joseph also wants that experience. He's, you know, clearly, according to an early history that he writes, he's very troubled about his own sinfulness. He wants God to forgive him. He wants mercy. And according to that history, he does experience it directly from Jesus Christ, which also tracks a bit with his family's background. These were people who did think that you could hear from God and Jesus Christ directly, and you could see them in visions, and you could have the sorts of powerful experiences for yourself.
You write this in the book, "The Smiths and the Macks didn't hear many sermons, but they sometimes heard directly from God."
Exactly. And they did have sort of, an anti-elitist mentality in that they weren't going to take what ministers or doctors or other sort of superiors would tell them. You know, they had their own thoughts. And when it came to religion, they definitely thought that God and Jesus Christ were, in addition to the Bible, more trustworthy sources of information than the local Methodist or Presbyterian preacher.
It seems like such a Protestant inclination. Don't tell me I have to go through a priest to get to God. I can get there myself.
Yeah, and it's very much in keeping with the flavor of the early 19th century in the United States. You know, the lid's just been pulled back on religious freedom and pluralism. And, you know, it's an environment in which there are an increasing number of religious options. And a lot of people, they do want to figure things out for themselves.
You say the reason Joseph Smith was successful was that he provided these provocative answers to the questions that American Christians were asking. What were they asking? I mean, some of the ones that you lay out in the book, you know, which of the churches is true? Are they just all wrong? What do I need to do to be saved? How do I prepare for an imminent return of Jesus? Like, what are the questions that are on the minds? Are these typical sort of religious questions? Were they particular to what was described as the burnt district, seemed to be a kind of particular kind of fervency and interest at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's always hard to say what's typical because, yeah. You know, in the early 1800s, it's a diverse country. There's not a single answer, but there are a lot of American Christians who are asking something akin to what Joseph asks in terms of which of these churches is true or all of them false. There were a fair number of Americans, not a majority. This is still not even an enormous minority. But there are a lot of people who, when they look around at these existing churches, and because there are a lot of them, it sort of raises some questions, and conclude, this isn't like the Christianity we read about in the Bible. Mm. You know, people aren't being healed. People aren't speaking in tongues. Nobody's prophesying. Or people aren't holding everything in common. So there is this broader movement, which is called primitivism in the early 1800s, in which Christians want to restore something akin to the New Testament church. And, you know, some people try to bring that about. You know, Joseph's ultimate answer is different. You know, it stretches back further, and I think it's more definitive in the sense of saying that this is Christ's one true church. But that basic question is something that did bother other Americans. There were other people who were asking at least similar questions.
Let's talk about his first vision. Let's put it that way. He said, I think it's interesting to say before we get there, is that Joseph Smith said that he could discern the location of buried objects by seeing them through a magical stone, this sort of seer stone. And it seems like there were a lot of people in the region who had these seer stones. Like this wasn't – I guess that's my question. Would people have found that, like in the area, to be weird or backward, or was that just sort of a common idea that gets to the idea of whether people had visions or had, you know – A real relationship with, you know, magic, I guess.
So this is one of the fault lines, really, in American Christianity. There are a lot of them. There are large numbers of people who would have regarded the use of seer stones or dowsing rods mm-hmm. or amulets or anything else along those lines as superstition, or maybe even something that would smack of Catholicism or the occult. So those practices could definitely be denounced. At the same time, there were a lot of people who did not see them as in conflict with Christianity. Hmm. So the Smiths have neighbors along the Palmyra-Manchester line, the Chase family. Now, the Chases are, I don't actually know to what extent they were fervent or active Methodists, but they're Methodists. And at the same time, Willard Chase and his daughter Sally, they definitely believe in the power of seer stones. It seems that Sally Chase is someone who introduces young Joseph Smith to the practice. I think maybe the simplest way of answering the question is that the Smiths certainly don't see such things as in conflict with Christianity. They see it as congruent. I think they see it as not just magic, but as access to spiritual power, one conduit to spiritual power.
So he has this kind of spiritual apprehension. He had said to a friend, you report in the book, that he wanted to get religion too. Like he wanted to feel and shout like the rest, but he said he could feel nothing. And that kind of anxiety about wanting a similar kind of experience that his mother talked about gets him to what you describe as a kind of breaking point, and it gets us to this first vision. Tell us how you understand it and what's happening. I mean, as you mentioned, the sort of truth claim part of this, again, we don't need to adjudicate here. There are multiple accounts of what happens and how it changes over time. But how do you understand this moment for Joseph Smith?
I think if I would boil it down, he's a young man or a boy turning into a man around 14 years of age. And he's already spiritually anxious, but also directionless because he has these spiritual anxieties about his sinfulness, which is quite understandable in the context of American culture circa 1820. And he doesn't know what to do about it. He's seen other people at revivals have these powerful experiences in which they repent of their sins and feel assured of God's salvation. Joseph hasn't had an experience like that. And perhaps given his family being aloof from churches, he doesn't have a minister to talk to. His parents wouldn't have recommended that. And he goes to God directly. And, you know, according to the story with which Latter-day Saints are most familiar, he goes out into a grove to pray by himself. And he feels assaulted by Satan. And then he sees a pillar of light. He sees light above the brightness of the sun. And either Jesus Christ or God the Father and Jesus Christ appear to him. Now, according to the account, he either cries out unto the Lord for mercy and forgiveness of sins, or he asks that question, you know, which of the churches is true? And, you know, Jesus has a message for him. Your sins are forgiven. The churches are all wrong. Don't join any of them. There's also the idea that Christ is going to return soon and there's going to be judgment for those who are in apostasy. Now, I just blended some of these accounts together and you alluded to truth claims. Yeah. I think as historians, we can't penetrate into exactly what Joseph Smith experienced in 1820. We can't recover through the tools of history what divine beings said to him at the time. But, you know, that basic story of a young man who is searching for the Lord and then sees and hears from him, that makes sense to me within the culture of Joseph's family and the culture in which he lived.
I guess we should just explain that, again, not to delve into the truth claim part of it, but the fact that it was Jesus Christ who said to him, none of these churches are true. That's important for Latter-day Saints because Jesus is different from God. They're separate entities. That's not a minor point for all Christians, of course. And again, you don't sort of adjudicate that point, but it's very critical for a lot of people because that isn't the initial way he describes it, and it seemed to have changed over time. But again, your point is just that he has this powerful kind of, or says he does, this powerful epiphanal moment. That's the thing to understand. Is that accurate?
No, that's accurate, and I find some of the arguments that people make about the first vision, I actually find them, I hope I'm not going to offend anybody too much, I find them a little bit tedious. Like, was there really a revival in Palmyra, New York in the spring of 1820 that tracks with what Joseph describes? Well, there are a lot of revivals in the area all of the time. Can we prove that this took place in June of 1820 or something like that? I don't think we can prove it, but I don't think it matters too much to the broader story whether it takes place in 1820 or 1821. And I also think in terms of that theological question, say, of the significance of seeing two personages, when Joseph crafts the story in its most famous form in the late 1830s, I'm not even convinced he's trying to make that theological point. You know, a lot of Americans in the early 1800s, they see Jesus Christ at the right hand of God the Father. Well, they're not emphasizing that these are two personages or two separate divine beings. Now, that does become a very important teaching to Joseph Smith and to Latter-day Saints going forward. But I just like to go back to the story's core. You know, we have this spiritually distraught young man who believes that he can hear directly from Jesus Christ. And the takeaways that we know about are your sins are forgiven and don't join any of the churches because they're all wrong. And I'm returning soon.
It's a myth. In some ways, maybe. I mean, Martin Luther saw lightning that told him to serve God and be a monk. Joan of Arc heard voices of saints that told her to engage in the project of, you know, working for God. Same thing here. Joseph Smith has a vision, he says, and it's a myth.
Well, and it does. Yeah, it does ultimately become a founding myth.
Sure.
I also refer to it, I think in the book, maybe elsewhere, as just an iconic American story.
Yeah.
You know, it's very democratic in terms of religion. You know, go out in the woods and find an answer for yourself.
Right.
You know, it doesn't really take on those mythical proportions for Latter-day Saints, you know, until some time has passed. For Joseph, he really splashes onto the scene with a book, not a vision. That's really how people get their introduction to him.
John Turner, his book is Joseph Smith, The Rise and Fall of an American Prophet. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the first in a two-part conversation with the historian John Turner. We're talking about his biography of Joseph Smith. We've been discussing Turner's approach to telling the story of such a contested life, but also how Smith's visions and ambitions and religious innovations fit into the Christian America of his time. The book is called Joseph Smith, The Rise and Fall of an American Prophet. Describe Joseph Smith's personality. In the book, you say he was audacious, sometimes outrageous. Was he vain? What was he like?
Toward the end of his life, you know, I think he did like to appear sort of in his resplendent uniform, maybe just like a little bit of preening there. But I don't see him as terribly vain. I think he was playful. I think he was mirthful. I think he did like pageantry and drama. Who's also just intensely sociable. There were a few moments of sort of melancholy or seclusion in his life, but for the most part, he loved being with people. He was a very down-to-earth prophet.
Was he shifty? I mean, you say in the book you wouldn't trust him with your own money.
Right. Yeah. So I have this line in the introduction, which is a little bit punchy. You know, that I wouldn't trust him with my money, my wife, or my daughter.
Yeah.
You know, the next paragraph has some more complimentary things. So if you're a faithful Latter-day Saint, don't give up on the book yet. No, I don't think he was shifty with money. What I really mean by that statement is that he was bad with money. Brigham Young has a retrospective quote, which basically says, you know, Joseph wasn't good with financial matters. Part of his audacity and boldness was that if he had a big project like the Kirtland Temple or simply building the community in Nauvoo, he would take on a lot of debt. So that's why I wouldn't trust him with my money.
I think the question of whether you would trust him with your wife or daughter, though, was he a womanizer? Was he a cad, a philanderer?
Great question. So I'll just say what I meant by that statement is that in the early 1840s, he proposes polygamous marriage to the wives of some of his associates, to some already married women, also to the daughters of some close associates. So that's what I meant by that statement. You know, that's a hard question to answer, Doug.
Well, that's what you meant by that statement. But that question still does hang out there, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think what I'd say is, for the most part, I do think that Joseph was upright in that respect. There's a lot of debate about an intimate relationship with a woman named Fanny Alger in the mid-1830s. Right. And for some researchers, that's a first plural marriage. For others, it's an affair. Mm-hmm. For still others, nothing really happened at all. I do tend to see that as a brief affair. Some of Joseph's close associates understood it that way. I think the evidence is a little bit murky. I'm not 100% certain about it. I do think that's a bit of an outlier, though, before plural marriage. Joseph, I don't think he wasn't a cad. There's not, I don't think, reliable information about sexual misbehavior from the late 1820s and other points in Joseph's life until we get to plural marriage, which, of course, is incredibly controversial.
But what that implies is that it was his desire for innovation or a purer kind of worship rather than just him creating some spiritual excuse for sexual gratification.
Yeah. So I don't think Joseph's primary purpose with polygamy was sexual gratification. I don't think there is all that much sex involved. I do think some of those plural marriages are consummated. You know, some of the women attest to that fact. But I don't think there was I don't think there was frequent sex. Children didn't result from those marriages, which makes it likely that there wasn't a whole lot of sex involved. So there had to be something else at the same time. I do think it's connected to Joseph's theology of human exaltation and glory. I actually think that also explains why he pursues that so recklessly, because I think he connects the extent of one's heavenly glory to the size of one's earthly family. So once he becomes convinced of this doctrine, he pursues it wholeheartedly and I think without regard for danger.
You make this interesting point early on in the book that many biblical figures and prophets behaved in morally questionable ways. Abraham told lies of convenience. Moses killed a man. David committed adultery with a woman and arranged to have her husband killed in battle. But therefore what? The fact that Smith behaved in questionable ways doesn't disqualify him from possibly being a man chosen by God to lead his one true church?
I think I actually am intruding a bit onto Latter-day Saint theology here in the sense of I don't think Latter-day Saints have a doctrine of prophetic perfection. So Muslims, for instance, believe that prophets are without sin. And I am a little bit bemused sometimes when I hear debates about Joseph's behavior connected to his prophetic mantle, just sort of along the lines that you outline, you know, well, if Joseph behaved in this way, he couldn't have been a prophet. And it does occur to me, actually, that Joseph very much emulated the biblical prophets. His brother Hiram once commented that Joseph has the spirit of all of the prophets. And Joseph, Abraham, Enoch, Solomon, these were all models for Joseph Smith. Now, I'm not saying that he read the Bible and said, well, they behaved in questionable ways, I can too. But simply, you know, that religious leaders, they can be rough-edged. And that doesn't mean that they can't accomplish remarkable things. I think what I had in mind there was, let's not be too quick to dismiss Joseph Smith if we perceive some moral flaws. That human beings are complex. religious leaders are not without sin. We shouldn't expect them to be. Let's deal with this man and all of his complexity and not reach hasty judgments.
It's John Turner. He's a professor of religious studies at George Mason University. Next week, we'll have part two of the conversation. We'll talk about the golden plates, Smith's religious innovations, his death, and his legacy. The book is Joseph Smith, The Rise and Fall of an American Prophet. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1, Instagram at Radio West, or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.